A modern labour movement is the product of the development of capitalism, a consequence of the appearance of the modern working class, and the separation of the masses of the people from ownership of the means of production. Australia was established in the capitalist era, and it has developed within the capitalist system. The immediate reason for the establishment of Australia was the overcrowding of British jails, but from the 1820s on, the demands of British textile manufacturers for Australian wool gave the impetus for capitalist development within Australia. The discovery of gold in 1851 had a profound effect on Australian development. Firstly, it provided a market for British capital. Secondly, its initial effect was to make wage labour scarce as thousands flocked to the gold fields. Wages increased in real terms, and although they declined when the number of strikes declined, they remained higher than they had been in the 1840s. High wages for labourers, plus the fact that the gold fields contained all social classes where rank made little or no difference, and a man could rise from rags to riches overnight, this put an end to the aristocratic pretensions of the squatters, who had seized prominence in the 1840s. The Eureka Stockade was not, as some romantics would have it, a proletarian or workers' revolt, but men who sought gold as their way out of wage slavery. Some did acquire enough capital to become small capitalists. The majority, of course, did not. And by the 1860s, these provided a ready-made supply of wage labourers. Yet the promise of easy capital lingered in one part of Australia or another well up into the 1890s. This had an important effect on the outlook of the labourer, who developed an outlook more akin to the petty bourgeois than to working-class consciousness. The 1860s was a period of relative stagnation, with struggles between the city merchants, immeasurably strengthened by the gold boom, and the squatters, over the latter's land and political monopoly. The urban poor, greedy for land, supported their city masters in their attack on the squatters. The Selection Acts of the 1860s was the direct outcome of this support, which aimed at the squatters' monopoly of the land, and promised the urban workers a self-sufficient farm of their own, a promise which in the main was not realised. During the period 1860 to 1890, often called the Long Boom, this saw a great influx of British capital into Australia in the pastoral and agricultural industry. Of much less importance were the investments in manufacturing, shops, mines, shippings and churches. The absence of large-scale manufacturing industry until a decade into the 20th century also kept the growing working class trapped within the mentality of the small proprietor. Added to this was the early growth of political democracy. By 1860, the Australian colonies enjoyed the secret ballot, manhood suffrage, though not women, and short, regular parliaments, things which had to wait many years to arrive in the United Kingdom. This was won by the urban middle classes in their fight against the squatter-dominated parliaments and required no development of class consciousness by the urban working class. The gold rushes had produced an egalitarian outlook and a degree of social mobility not found anywhere else in the empire, but it was not a socialist consciousness, but one which was accepted by the liberal middle class well into the 20th century. Indeed, the first Labour government of 1904 had a non-Labour Attorney General, despite the fact that Billy Hughes is qualified as a barrister. The Labour Party didn't consider it proper that anybody so inexperienced should hold such an august position. Such socialist ideas as existed were utopian, and popular books of the time were Edward Bellamy's book Looking Backwards, in which the hero awakes after 100 years' sleep to find himself in a perfect society. This, of course, avoided all the transitional problems. David Simon of the Age described himself as a socialist, while William Lane defined socialism as, quote, being mates. These socialist ideas were part of the largely pre-industrial environment in which they flourished. The enemy was not capitalism, but bankers and land monopolists. The traditional enemy of the petty bourgeois, the small farmer and the small businessman, and for wage labourers seeing the possibility of becoming a small proprietor, they became the enemy for him as well. It's very revealing to look at the 1894 platform of the Labour Party, which shows clearly that although labouring men from 1840 to 90 were often working class, their consciousness was petty bourgeois. The rank-and-file opinion had been consulted on the policy to be adopted by the party. The order of priority was determined by exhaustive ballot, and the top of the list came land value tax. Second was mining on private property, to ensure that the gold rush would never end. And third and fourth were abolition of the upper house and local government, both dominated by the landed interests. Sixth came call for a state bank to beat the moneylenders. And second last came the 8-hour day, the only working class reform which was amended 2 years later to, quote, where practicable in order to secure the farmers' vote, end of quote. An artisan opponent of the 8-hour day at a meeting asked this, quote, would any man in this room, who ever expects to be a master for himself, consent to work for 8 hours for 16 shillings if he might obtain 20 shillings for 10 hours? The last point shows both the relatively high wages of the labourer and the expectation of most of the labourers. This petty bourgeois level of thinking dominated working class organisations, the earliest of which was formed during the late 1850s. Because of the relatively high wages, the earliest struggles were for the 8-hour day, and it was in the building industry that success first came. This led to the state trades and labour councils in the 1850s, leading to the first intercolonial conference in 1879. But these early unions were essentially craft unions. The 1870s saw the rise of new unionism. These were mass national unions comprising unskilled and semi-skilled workers, the miners, the shearers, and the general rural worker, and of course the seamen. These were outside the ambit of the trades council centred in the city. These were the most proletarian elements in industries where capitalist ownership was far more concentrated, and capitalist exploitation was clearer than in the secondary industries where class distinctions were somewhat blurred. Even by 1891, only 25% of occupied workers in New South Wales and Victoria were engaged in small-scale manufacturing. It was these new unions that supplied the great fighting force for the strikes of the 1890s. The city unions were craft unions, little more than benefit societies, aimed at providing sustenance to ill or unemployed members. The typical unionist was a pillar of the community. The decision to build the Melbourne Trades Hall, for example, was largely because the delegates objected to meeting in hotels. It's also worth quoting the main objectives of the Lambing Flat Miners Protection League. One was the promulgation of the Word of God. The other was to use their utmost energies to preserve order and to protect property and the rights of every individual, and to seize, secure and hand over to government authorities any thief, robber or ruffian who violates the law of the country. End of quote. Humphrey McQueen has added to this by showing that the racism of the time was shared in full by the working class and its unions, and coloured labour was seen as a threat to living standards. This was not merely an economic consideration, but full-blown racism to non-Europeans, as a look at Henry Lawson will show, or as J.C. Watson said in 1901, he was the first Labour Prime Minister, quote, the question is whether we would desire that our sisters or our brothers would be married into any of these races to which we object, end of quote. Despite much of its character, the boom of the 1870s and the 1880s enabled the rapid extension of unionism and the securing of wage and condition concessions. When the boom bubble burst, the unions were determined to consolidate the gains won, and employers were less willing to make concessions and responded by forming various employer organisations. The strike, which lasted from 1891 to 1894, exhausted and defeated the unions. bad economic conditions, the extensive use of so-called free, i.e. scab labour, and the extensive use of the state police, law courts and the state generally by the employers against the unions resulted in defeat for the union movement. This and the hostility of the capitalist press to the labour movement led to a rising of class consciousness, though by no means was there a revolutionary situation. In 1890, there were still more domestic servants than there were trade unionists. Thus, although a considerable class consciousness was needed to establish the ALP, the general objective was social reform, not socialism. The idea of separate political organisation did not originate in the defeat of the unions in the 1890s, but the trade unions began more earnestly to organise the new Labour parties. It was the committees of the Trades Hall that established the political leagues. These leagues from the first represented both the trade unions and the labour leagues in their conferences. There were minorities within the ALP, like the Victorian Socialist Party, which sought to get the ALP to adopt a socialist objective. But until 1921, all that had been achieved was, quote, the collective ownership of monopolies, end of quote, in the Federal Platform of 1905. ALP policy in these early days included support for arbitration, not a strategy based on class struggle, white Australia, and a gradual acceptance of the support link with Imperial Britain. This last policy is interesting because loyalty to the British Crown increased after the Russian-Japanese War of 1904-5, when the Japanese won a surprising victory. And the fear of Asians saw Labour men swinging to the protection of the British Navy. During the 1890s, the radical journals like the Bulletin were aggressively Republican. But by 1914, Labour Prime Minister Fisher was pledging support to the Empire, quote, to the last man and the last shilling, end of quote. The ALP, as it emerged in the 1890s and after Federation in 1900, was Liberal Labour rather than a Socialist Labour Party. In policy, they differed from the Liberals largely in their enthusiasm with which they sought to complete the framework of capitalist democracy, and secondly, by their acceptance of state amelioration of conditions as a philosophy, and not, as the Liberals regarded it, merely as an expedient. The reasons for this are as follows. Australia's capitalist economy was still in its early development and was still in many ways particularly a colonial country. Secondly, although monopoly control developed in wool, cattle and mining, and it was these that had the mass unions and the first demands for nationalisation, generally, manufacturing industries, at least till 1914, were small scale. In 1908, for example, the average factory employed only 19.8 employees. Even these factories were light industry. In fact, there was no steel industry in Australia until 1914. These factors influenced the structure and outlook of the Australian labour movement. The small factory unit made for limited class consciousness. That is, workers didn't really think of themselves first and foremost as workers. The generally high wages, particularly since 1851, were based on more of a sharing out amongst the workers, particularly the skilled workers, of parts of the profits from the sale of scarce raw materials overseas. Under these conditions, unionism in the cities was essentially craft unionism, mainly skilled workers, and union leaders and labour MPs were drawn from the upper crust of the skilled workers, often called the labour aristocracy. This layer, now enshrined as a union bureaucracy, acts as a buffer between the bourgeoisie and the working class. They fitted into the state and Commonwealth parliaments. They shared the same basic acceptance of society as did their non-Labour MPs. The third point is the direct responsibility of Australian governments for many economic activities, such as railways, posts, telegraphs and roads, produced an acceptance of state enterprises as a possible alternative to private capitalist enterprise in many fields. This attitude was strengthened by the development in the states of social services and pensions. Reforming zeal, rather than fundamental changes, was stimulated as concessions were wrung from the capitalist class in quick succession. These included abolition of voting anomalies, universal suffrage, not merely for men, health acts, mining acts, and the eight-hour day legislation. From 1907 on, there was increasing criticism by the industrial wing of the Labour MPs and the gradual growth of disenchantment with the moderate line of the ALP leadership. This was due to an increasing drift towards monopolisation of industry, the increasing exploitation of labour, and the fall in real wages. Thus, we see in its origins, the ALP was not born a socialist party. It never aspired to abolish private ownership of the factories, the land, and the financial institutions. In fact, in words of striking relevance today, Lenin in 1920 wrote of the Labour Party, quote, "Of course, the bulk of the members of the Labour Party are workers. However, whether a party is really a political party of the workers or not depends not only whether it consists of workers, but also upon who leads it, upon the contents of its activities and of its political tactics. Only the latter determines whether we have before us a real party of the proletariat. From this point of view, the only correct one, the Labour Party is a thoroughly bourgeois party, because although it consists of workers, it is led by reactionaries, and the worst reactionaries at that, who act fully in the spirit of the bourgeoisie. It is an organisation of the bourgeoisie which exists to systematically dupe the workers with the aid of the British Noskies and Scheidemans, who were notorious trade union bureaucrats." This was Lenin's speech on affiliation to the Labour Party on the 6th of August, 1920.